Mark Olmsted found out he had HIV at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, when the disease was the death sentence. Figuring he had nothing to lose, he pulled off a string of scams, including credit card fraud, insurance fraud, dealing crystal meth, and faking his own death, assuming he'd be dead for real before any of the consequences caught up to him. Except he didn't die. Which makes Kim Daly wonder,
why is this not a movie?
Hello and welcome to Why Is This Not a Movie, the podcast where we look at a moment in history or a book or a story we can rip from the headlines and ask Hollywood why no one's ever put it onto the big screen. I'm Mike Vago, and joining me this week is Kim Daly, whose book, The True Crime File, is a compendium of serial killers, kidnappings, cons, and survivors and their stories. It's available for pre-order now and hits bookstores May 10th. Kim, thanks so much for coming on the show. Tell us about Mark Olmsted and his unexpectedly long life of crime.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me. The story of Mark Olmsted is really the story of the brothers Olmsted, I think. So it's Mark and his brother Luke, who's sort of like a large looming secondary character. I'll also say I got most of this information from a 2019 GQ article called The Curious Cons of the Man Who Wouldn't Die by Nathaniel Penn. Should throw out a little credit because that's like where most of information on the Olmsted brothers comes from. So we have Luke and Mark. Luke is the older child. He's like the golden child. He becomes a doctor. He's reserved. He's socially shy. Mark is younger, sort of like renegade, rebel, fun-loving, sex positive, active on the New York City gay scene in the 80s. So they're very different, but they love each other very much. And I don't know the exact year, but Mark tests HIV positive in the early 80s. And by 1988, they end up disclosing to each other that they're both Luke and Mark are HIV positive. And their responses to this are characteristically divergent, I would say. Luke, who's the doctor, he decides that he can solve HIV AIDS and the whole crisis with science. So he is going to cure HIV AIDS. Like he's, you know, fighting against the clock, and he's positive like that he's going to figure it out. Mark, on the other hand, he just wants to live while he's alive, basically. And so he's just like partying, and, you know, everyone around them is dying. It's just like very apocalyptic to have, you know, in such a concentrated community, so many people dying. And Luke ends up, he doesn't cure HIV AIDS, spoiler alert, he dies in 1991. And so this is where Mark starts scamming and scheming. So I'll go over, I know you listed sort of like the charges against him, but the specifics of this are like pretty brilliant, I think. And there's a quote from Stephen Weissman, who is a professor at Bentley University. He's an expert on scams and identity theft, so that's a fun job. And he said, this story reminds me why scam artists are the only criminals we call artists.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. So at this time, Mark had moved out to LA to live with Luke, and they were sort of taking care of each other before Luke dies. Mark now is living alone in the apartment in LA, and he can't afford it. So it all starts, he continues getting Luke's disability checks, and he needs the money, so he cashes them. So this is like the first forgery. And it's easy because it's the 90s, and the bank, Luke's bank is in San Diego. He's in LA, everything's done by mail. Luke's license comes up for renewal. Mark goes to the DMV. You know, they're brothers, they look alike. So he gets this second ID with Luke's name on it. So he's now, Mark is, he's draining Luke's bank account. He's running up debt on the credit cards. You know, he's buying expensive furniture. I think he traveled. I don't know. He might have traveled for work. I don't know if that was like a fun trip, but he's partying, he's drinking a lot, he's doing crystal meth to revive his libido, which is inhibited from the meds that he's taking for HIV. And yeah, he's just living his life on Luke's disability. So one day he gets Luke's credit card bill, and it's like, you know, like tens of thousands of dollars. And it says, he notices at the bottom, there's a note that says, Mark here to insure the full balance in the event of the cardholder's death. And so Mark checks the box. And then the scam sort of expands. He doctors Luke's death certificate, and he postdates it 1992. And this is, you know, it's the 90s. So he's like cutting and pasting and photocopying this. This is like pre-Photoshop. And he sends it to the credit card company, and the next statement comes back and it's $0. So he wiped out the debt. And so he starts doing this on multiple credit cards. He's now doctoring his own name, faking his own death, sending his death certificate to the credit card companies with you know, the credit cards that are in his name, sending, you know, others to the credit card companies in Luke's name. It's, I mean, it's got to get confusing. He must have been super organized.
One of the things, you know, him sort of cutting and photocopying and all that stuff reminds me of Catch Me If You Can, where like Leo's character is, you know, kind of got an X-Acto knife and is forging documents. But one of the things from like scam artist period pieces, even like Fear and Loathing Las Vegas, where Hunter S. Thompson's kind of doing all this credit card scams and stuff, is just how little security there was to anything before the internet era.
Right.
Like you couldn't get away with anything that he's doing today.
No way. No, I mean, like even the fact that this is all over, this is like by mail.
Yeah, yeah.
All by mail. Like for this, like it's not even like, they don't even need the IDs. Like he renews Luke's ID and that's going to help him later on. But for this scam, I'm not sure he even needs like a photocopy of the ID. Like it's not like, you know, you need it with a death certificate. I'm not sure about the details. It doesn't matter because he has the ID, right?
Meanwhile, you need like a retina scan if you have the new iPhone.
Right, exactly. So this speaks to that especially. One of my favorite details in this story is that Mark gets a call from a credit card company. So he has to remember who he is when he gets these calls, right? So he gets a call about Mark. Mark gets a call about Mark's death certificate. So he hears this and he says, okay, I have to pretend I'm Luke. So I have to like switch to Luke mode. And the person, the credit card company says that it's missing the seal. It's like a certified embossed seal that you need. And he's like, what are you talking about? It's on the back. And I guess the person, the credit card company just looks really quickly and she's like, oh yeah, sorry. It's on the back. I see it. But the seal, it said, it read CC, right? It's certified copy. But the seal actually said Corona Cougars, which is the name of a little league baseball team. And he bought the seal at Office Depot. That's what he's using. There was another time where he's applying for Social Security as Luke. And the clerk said, Luke Olmsted is dead. And Mark begins to protest. And the clerk is like, oh, I'm sorry. It must have been a mistake. So he's dealing in death here. So these people are, it is a really sensitive subject. It's a really sensitive time. A lot of people are dying. And I think that he's also sort of benefiting from that, because these people don't want to push, because he's like, this is my brother, like this is myself, I'm not dead kind of thing.
It's not quite the killing your parents then crying mercy because you're an orphan, but it's kind of in the ballpark.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, and he's sick, so I'm sure, you know, they're saying like, your Luke Olmsted is dead, and he's like, what do you mean? I'm not dead, I'm right here. And it's like, he probably doesn't look so hot at this
point. And I've got a driver's license to prove it.
Yes, exactly. So yeah, so he continues running up debt on the credit cards. He is trying to pay some of the debt off. So he takes it's called a viatical settlement, which was apparently very popular in the 80s and 90s during the HIV AIDS crisis, which is basically somebody buys, like an investor buys your life insurance policy.
Oh, okay. It
sounds awful. Like, so yeah. They buy it for more than the cash amount that it's worth if you cash it in, but less than the actual settlement that you would get or that your survivors would get after you die.
Right.
And of course, like in the 80s and 90s, people are thinking this is a great investment because the life expectancy for someone diagnosed with HIV was very short. So he has the viatical settlement. It starts to run out. And so Mark's crystal meth supplier is like, hey, I'll help you out at becoming a dealer. So he starts, I guess, this small business dealing crystal meth. It's very, you know, like fast and loose. It's not very controlled. He has people like coming and going from his apartment at all hours. So you know, he's not living discreetly. He's running these scams. He's selling crystal meth, but he's positive that any moment he's going to die. So he's not living discreetly.
Yeah. He's just being reckless and like,
yeah. And it's like,
well, one of the funny things about the GQ article you mentioned is that the way it frames the meth dealing is like, at least he was working. Like, this is the one thing that like the other scams, he was just kind of ripping people off for money. And here he actually sort of was managing a business.
Yeah. Even if it was true. And he's trying to pay off some of the debt, right? So yeah, it's his small business. But I think like when I go through this, I always think like, I think he was 30 when he was diagnosed with HIV/AIDS, and he's like, well, with HIV, not with AIDS, that's coming up. And it's like, what if you were in your 20s or 30s and someone told you that you were going to die and basically everyone you know is going to die? Like, it's so apocalyptic.
Like, yeah, like, of course you're going to be nihilistic and like...
Yeah, like, what would you do if someone told you that, you know, really you only have like maybe a few years to live, and you're watching everyone around you die, including like the person closest to you, and you're like, well, that's going to happen to me. Like, it, I don't know. I just, you know, like, obviously what I'm getting at is that I think Mark is a very sympathetic character. I think that he's a criminal, but he's not a villain. And the villain here is very obviously HIV.
It's hard to even kind of fathom in, you know, in 2020s, even in the middle of a pandemic that has killed many people, just how devastating the AIDS epidemic was if you were a gay man, mm-hmm. you know, in the 80s before the, because at least even with COVID, as much, you know, it's killed several million people around the world, but there's also a vaccine for it. There's treatments. There is also, whereas with HIV in the early days, there was nothing. Nobody had any idea. And the government was sort of open, you know, the Reagan administration was openly hostile to helping anybody.
Exactly. So that like, takes it even further where, you know, his scam, he's ripping off the government. He's taking government aid. And it's the government that is perpetuating the AIDS crisis. Reagan is refusing to even recognize that it's a thing. And that is like the whole, you know, what, 81 to 89, right?
Yeah.
I was born right in the middle there. So that is like the whole beginning of when he was diagnosed up to where, you know, he finds out that Luke also has HIV. I don't know. And then he's also stealing from credit card companies, which is like, okay, you know, if you have more sympathy for credit cards companies than you do for somebody who
has a terminal illness.
Yeah, that's exactly, that's between you and your God. Like, that's,
Well, it's almost like Steven Spielberg once said about Indiana Jones, is that he hit on a brilliant formula, which is that making the villains Nazis, because you could kill as many as you wanted to in horrible ways and no one would ever be, you know, sympathizing with them.
Right.
And it's kind of the same thing with the credit card companies. Like, you know, nobody gets to the end of Fight Club is like, oh, the poor credit card companies.
Right. And he's stealing, you know, tens of thousands of dollars from them, which is nothing.
Yeah. From $1 billion companies. Yeah.
It's just absolutely nothing. I think.
Actually, let me, the story has kind of obvious parallels to Breaking Bad, somebody with a terminal illness selling crystal meth. Yeah. And the secret of Breaking Bad was they didn't shy away from showing you how awful Walter White was, but there was always somebody worse. Mm-hmm. And so you're rooting for him. And so having his sort of enemies be the credit card companies and the Reagan administration.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're always gonna vote for him, no matter what he does.
Right, exactly. So
also, and this is the secret of not just Breaking Bad, but like any heist movie, you know, any kind of con artist in fiction, is that we will root for somebody to do bad things if they're clever.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, and losing his brother makes him sympathetic, and having what, you know, was then considered a very quickly terminal illness, like all those things also make him sympathetic. But you're also, just as a character, you're kind of on his side because he's getting away with it all. Mm-hmm. He's outfoxing everybody. Right. And that's always appealing to us.
Yeah, he's clever and he's not killing anyone except for himself. And it takes a turn in 2002. I mean, first he becomes really ill and he finds out that he has AIDS. So his HIV has progressed to AIDS. But then doctors try one more. So at this point, there are several medications that treat HIV and AIDS, not to the extent that they do today, but none of them are working. None of them have worked for Mark. And then the doctors try one more combination of antivirals. And within a year, the HIV is no longer detectable in his blood. So he's going to survive. So now he's deep in debt. He's selling crystal meth, and
using it.
And addicted to it, yes. And he's like, oh, okay.
Lucky me.
Like, oh, I mean, I like imagine that, the complexity of that moment where you're like, okay, oh my God, like I'm gonna live. Wow. And then like the moment of that, and then like, oh fuck, like what?
Yeah, somebody who's really done like the opposite of planning for a future.
Exactly. Yeah. And he's like, talk about rooting for him because he's clever. Like, you know, this guy speaks like five languages. Like he had like a really bright future if all of this you know, had not. I believe that he may not, like, I don't know, this is all speculation, but I don't think that he may would have even been a criminal if it wasn't for this like huge upset in his life and in the world. So obviously very sympathetic to him. I mean, who knows? Like, you know, he obviously like has, you know, issues with addiction. So that might have upended his life anyway. But so anyway, yeah. So in August 2003, so this is like just around the time where the HIV is undetectable. Narcotics officers raid his apartment. He's sentenced to 300 hours of community service and fined $2,200. So not so bad. So he stops the scams after this. So, you know, no more applying for Social Security, no more credit card scams, no more doctoring death certificates.
But to be clear, they catch him for selling meth, but they don't catch him for anything else he's done.
So he tries to go straight for the scam. So at this point, yeah, they busted him for selling drugs. They raided his apartment. Oh, wait, they haven't found all his passports yet, but that's next, coming up soon.
Okay.
So yeah, so, but he tries to stop the scams, but he can't stop selling meth because he is addicted. Well, he's addicted to the drug and, you know, this is basically the career that he's known for however many years. So he's also, you know, sort of addicted to the easy money. So a few months later, October 2003, so the bust happens in August. In October, he attempts to declare himself dead one more time. And he's doctoring the death certificate on his computer in Photoshop at this point. It's 2003. So he has updated that. And then shortly after that, his apartment's raided again. And this is when they find out what's been going on. So they find all 6 passports in his name and in Luke's name, and they all have his Mark's picture on them. Yeah. So Mark tells the officers that he's Luke. I'm not clear why he does that. Maybe because of the prior, I don't know. He tells the officers that he's Luke and that Mark is dead. It might have been like, my best guess is that the defense is that like Mark did all this. Right. Because he just doctored the death certificate for October 2003. And this is February 2004. So maybe
he was going, you can say like Mark did this and you just missed him.
Yeah. He just died. And I'm his brother here cleaning up his messes. But then like how, like, you know, all the passports and this, that, and the other thing. And then they fingerprint him and they're like, no, you're Mark. Like, what are you talking about?
Just
arrested you last year. So he pleads guilty to possession of controlled substance for sale, manufacturing false documents, and he's sentenced to 16 months in prison. So not.
Yeah, again, so like kind of a slap on the wrist again.
And in the GQ article, there's this very dramatic scene where, very cinematic, in prison where he's getting beat up and he starts bleeding, and he sort of like wields his blood as a weapon against the fellow prisoners. And he's like, I have HIV and I'm gonna like infect you motherfuckers if you don't stay away from me. And it's interesting because it's spun as this like moment of radical self-acceptance, almost like he's coming to terms with, you know, with everything. And he spends his time in prison getting clean. I mean, in the GQ article, it makes it pretty clear that he's in a 12-step program. So he's sort of like writing letters, making amends. And I think now, or like in 2019, which is when this article came out, he was sort of, I think he was doing dubbing for movies, actually. So that's interesting. I'm not making a lot of money, just like trying to stay clean.
Because he tries to sell a screenplay at one point too, doesn't he?
Probably, because he's the one who contacted the journalist, Penn. He's the one who contacted him about this story. So he is trying to publicize it. So you know, anyone who hears this, if you want to make a movie, the screenplay is already written.
I know. I was going to say, we don't usually talk about who should write this, but maybe he writes this himself. And
yeah, why not? So I think that, that's the story. When I think of it as a movie, I mean, I feel like it could go... I mean, I don't know how he wrote it. If he already wrote it, like, I would be really interested in how he did it. But it's like, I feel like you could either go straight through with sort of like a prologue of their childhood and then like cut to the 80s and just like, you know, sort of go from there. But I also was thinking it could be framed like, I mean, I know that using like 12-step programs in movies and in film and television is sort of controversial, but like framed as Mark in a 12-step meeting as a speaker and mirroring like the sort of storytelling that kind of jumps around when somebody tells their own story.
Well, because like, what I was going to say about their childhood is that I think it's relevant for setting up the characters because Luke was kind of the older brother was kind of the golden boy.
Right.
Who was outgoing and successful and athletic. And Mark always felt like he was in his shadow. And then Luke's dying and he has to take care of him. And then he kind of assumes his identity. Like there's a lot of psychology there, even apart from the scam aspect of it.
Right.
And then there was also when they were younger, Mark was out of the closet at a pretty young age. And Luke had been closeted until Mark said he was gay. And he was like, oh, actually, I'm gay too. And I've, been hiding it all this time. Like there's kind of a lot of psychology between the brothers that the backstory sets up. But I kind of feel like you maybe want that in flashback. I don't know that you want to do like a biopic where you just start from childhood and work your way all the way through.
Right, exactly.
I feel like you can jump back into this stuff as you need it to inform the characters and the relationship.
Right, yeah. Like as it becomes relevant, there's another backstory happening, you know, like, yeah. So that works for, I did say.
Oh, that being said, I don't know if you want to start it in the present or at least at the end of the story and flashback because part of what's hanging over this is thinking he's going to die at any point. You almost kind of need to feel that as the audience too. So it's a little bit of a surprise that like, oh, it's 2002 and he's been living with HIV for almost 20 years and he's still alive.
Right. Maybe it starts in that moment where he realizes he's going to survive, like right before that moment, maybe. That's the same issue, actually. Maybe that's
or when the police bust him or... Yeah, it's, I mean, there's a bunch of different ways you could go. You could start with the diagnosis and then, he starts to,
right.
And then you go backwards to the relationship with his brother and coming out and everything that led up to it. Well, you also go forward with him getting deeper and deeper into this life of crime.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. You could do, there's a lot of different nonlinear ways you could do this, or you could just go straight through it.
In the book, the story that I put together for the book, I start with them disclosing to each other, but that's sort of like these stories are sort of short and sweet, so I just kind of have to just like get it rolling as usual. Like,
but you know what, so are movies, really, you know, compared to like writing a novel or writing a nonfiction book about just this, you need to really hit the, like, that's the emotional crux of it, is that he has this diagnosis, he loses his brother, you know, he kind of has nothing to live for because he thinks he's not going to live that long, and that's kind of the engine that drives this whole thing. Like you were saying, like there's no real reason to believe he would have been a criminal, you know, if he hadn't been diagnosed, if he hadn't lost his brother, if nothing had happened.
Right.
And so that's the thing that drives him as a character, and it's the thing that drives the story. And so it is kind of a good place to start and just get right into it.
I also have this note, tons of party scenes and funeral scenes to capture the apocalyptic atmosphere of the time and to have the epidemic or pandemic, whichever you want to call it, so concentrated in this particular community. And that does sort of mirror that like disruption of so many lives in their 20s and 30s. So
that actually gave me an idea for a director. Do you want to talk more about the story? Do you want to get into who direct?
No, let's go into that. I don't have an extensive list. I tried.
I mean, I had two and then I just thought of somebody else.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I talked about the sort of obvious parallels to Breaking Bad. So my starting place was Michelle MacLaren, who's like a veteran TV director who, she did a lot of the memorable episodes of Breaking Bad, and she worked on The Walking Dead and Game of Thrones and The Deuce. And she's great at keeping sustained tension going as desperate people do bad things that will surely catch up to them. Like that's kind of the running theme on a lot of the shows she's worked on. And she's also, I brought her up before on the show because she's somebody who's done some of the best prestige TV of the last couple of years without making the jump to movies. She was considered for the Wonder Woman movie and got passed over. But then I also felt it was a little bit too on the nose to have somebody best known for a show about somebody with a terminal illness selling meth.
Right.
And it seemed like too pat an answer. Then I went to Emerald Fennell, who directed Promising Young Woman last year.
That's a great one. Oh my God. I can't believe I didn't think of her. I adore her.
Well, it's only, you know, it was only her debut feature, but you know, the movie's a psychological revenge thriller, but some of the underlying elements just seem really relevant. Like Carey Mulligan's character slips in and out of different personas. And you're on her side and afraid for her safety, but you're also a little scared of what she's capable of. And it all feels like a good fit for Mark Olmsted. When you were talking about going back and forth between the funeral and the party scenes, because there is such a range of emotions that this kind of hits you with all at once. I thought about Kimberly Pierce, who directed Boys Don't Cry.
Okay.
Because one of the things that got me with that is that there's this thrill of Brent and Tina, you know, being in this very sort of hostile environment to a trans man and being able to pass and kind of hanging out with the other dudes and like being able to live his authentic life and get away with it. Mm-hmm. Because there's this ever-present threat of danger and violence, especially because you know how it ends. And you know it's going to end in tragedy. And there's this right. bubble of joy that he gets to experience before it pops. And it's such this, like, it really hit me hard emotionally because there's such a joy in him being able to be his authentic self, and you know it's not going to last. And mm-hmm. so that kind of made me think of this story too. Except in, like, Mark Olmsted's case, the bubble doesn't really pop. Like, it pops in the sense that his crimes catch up to him, but the death that he's been sort of building his whole life around doesn't happen.
Right, yeah. Anticlimactic in that way.
But just the emotional kind of contrast of these wild parties and funerals and kind of going back and forth and this kind of, you know, he's energized to take all these chances and do all these things, you know, most of which are criminal or very unhealthy, but like you said, to try to like live his life while he still can, mm-hmm. you know, while also knowing that with any kind of scam artist story, there's always the, like, when's the hammer going to drop when the authorities catch up to him? And then there's also the, you know, he expects he's going to die at any moment. So the audience is waiting for that to hit too. So every kind of visceral thrill of him getting away with something, there's also hanging over it that, like, when are one of these things going to catch up to him, either AIDS or the, you know, the law.
Right. Yeah. And I also think there is some tension. I don't know if this is going to sound ridiculous when I say it out loud. I think a lot of this is sort of playful, like the scams in particular, because they're so kind of like fuck the government. And
oh yeah, yeah.
Like, I do think that, you know, like the Little League stamp, like the cutting and pasting like, where is he photo? He doesn't have a photocopier in his home, I'm assuming.
He's so, like, going to Kinko's and doing this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Or like, yeah, was Kinko's around in the 90s?
there are all these small moments throughout the story, like the seal from the Little League team, where like he's so close to getting caught.
Right.
And then he doesn't. And it's often because he's just dealing with like a bored public servant who isn't that invested.
Right. And yeah. And that's such a contrast from the aliveness of a community on the brink of death, kind of. And you have these like public servants who are just grinding through the day and they're just like, all right.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whereas he, you sort of have this thrill as he keeps getting away with stuff.
Right. Yeah. And he's just like, I don't know. It's like this wonderment at survival, kind of.
Oh, absolutely. And
like, every day is a miracle.
Well, that feeling alive on the brink of death, like, is very literalized with HIV.
Right.
But it's also a really terrific metaphor for being a scam artist, because you're doing these really kind of thrilling, daring things, and every single time you're risking that it's all going to come crashing down.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, yeah, thematically, that just dovetails so nicely. We didn't have to write it. It really happened.
Right. Yeah. So I do think of, like, this is like really heavy, heavy material, but there is like also this lightness to it.
You need that to make the heavy material bearable. You know, it's the same reason people were having wild parties in the 80s as the community was being devastated by AIDS, because mm-hmm. like it can't just be doom and destruction. Like, our psyches can't handle that. You need to blow off steam and you need to enjoy life when you can, and like all that
right.
stuff. And it's the same thing for a movie audience. You're like, it can't just be all trauma and grief, and you know, you need to have some levity and you need to have some joy in here somewhere.
Exactly. That's exactly what I was thinking. Like, that's why this would make a great movie. It's just like, it's just all there. It's just like such a great story. One of the things I thought, like, it's a great time for it as well, is because, you know, there's a new generation of queer people coming up who don't remember the AIDS crisis. And there was a television show in the UK called It's a Sin. It's like, I watched it. I loved it. I think it's been pretty popular. It was acclaimed. I think it's about the AIDS crisis in London. And it's just like, to think like the actors playing these young men in the show don't even remember that this happened.
Oh, I know. And like, I'm 46. I'm old enough that like I was a kid when this was going on, so I was aware. But not having really, you know, as a child and as a straight man, it wasn't hitting home the way, I wasn't in the middle of it or anything. I was aware of it on the news and stuff. But one thing pretty recently that stayed with me was Scott Thompson from Kids in the Hall was on Marc Maron. And mm-hmm. he was, you know, Maron was kind of grinding his gears about Trump and how awful he was. And Thompson was like, yeah, he's pretty bad. I don't know. And he's like, what do you mean? How can you not hate this guy? And he's like, oh yeah, he's bad and I hate him. But like, I'm a gay man who grew up in the 80s where everybody around me was dying and half the country was rooting for the virus.
Right.
Like nothing's ever going to be that bad again.
Right.
And I think that level of just mass death and despair in a very close-knit community that was already having to deal with bigotry and, you know, like was already a very like marginalized community to begin with. You know, as much as everything feels like it's going to hell now for a myriad of reasons, yeah, nothing is that bad.
Yeah. I mean, not like it, everything has to be digestible, but it is a great way to frame it. But another thing it makes me think of is like gay representation. I have a friend who talks about this often, and I remember this too, like growing up, like, you know, it was like every storyline that was like inclusive of gay men was a tragedy for like years.
Oh yeah.
So this is, to some extent it is that, and to some extent it's not, because he survives. So it really shows like
that it's almost flipping the tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're also at a stage where, you know, we've kind of gotten to the next, you know, at least somewhat, the next sort of level of representation that you want, where you have queer characters where that's not what their story is about.
Right.
And it took a long time to get there. So now that you can go back and revisit what, you know, would have been a very tropey story if it were told 10, 20 years ago about, you know, you're only telling a story about a gay man who has AIDS and is dealing with, you know, prejudice or whatever. But you're also kind of flipping that story in his ear, because it's not kill your gays. It's your gays survive against all odds.
Right. Yeah. It's part of the story, but it's not necessarily the story. It's not a story of a scam artist who has HIV.
Yeah. That's kind of the thrust of it. And it's also, it's a great story to be in a movie because it's a bunch of different kinds of movies. You know, it's a scam artist movie. It's a dealing with terminal illness movie. It's a story of these two brothers. It's a period piece about this devastating time in their history. Like, it works on all these different levels that all kind of reinforce each other. And so it doesn't have to be about any one thing. It's ultimately about the specificity of this guy, because there were many people who had AIDS and thought they were going to die and didn't become scam artists. And there were many scam artists who weren't mourning their, you know, sibling. And, mm-hmm. you know, like all of these things taken together tell a very specific story. And that's always more interesting than just, let's tell a story about a guy who has AIDS, or let's tell a story about a guy who's in the creditor companies. Like,
it is a very full story. It's a lot. It does really make me think that if this guy has a screenplay, like, I hope that somebody.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's gonna be good. I find it really interesting that the article came out in 2019, and now it's like, I don't know. I do think that the pandemic makes these stories more relevant. And I know that there has been some dialogue, I don't think it's like very prevalent, about, you know, this idea that like we've never been through something like this before. And to some extent that's true. But like saying that there hasn't been any sort of like illness, like HIV/AIDS is considered an epidemic, not a pandemic. But that I think is like a little controversial. You know, in the past 40 years, 35 million people worldwide have died of AIDS-related illness. And I just think saying like, we've never been through anything even remotely like this in our lifetime is like a little bit of a slap in the face. Like, oh, it's not, you know, like the, like COVID is not HIV/AIDS, obviously, but we're kind of saying like, well, because it didn't affect our communities and it only affected these marginalized communities, it doesn't count.
Yeah. And I've read several people's theories about why conservatives just latched onto anti-masks and anti-vaccination and stuff, is because I think they went into this with the mindset of, oh, it's killing, you know, because it hit New York and the East Coast hardest first. And early on, the death rate was highest among African Americans. And so they're like, oh, it's killing big city liberals and Black people. Good.
Yeah.
And then it flipped and now it's killing Republicans because they didn't want to wear masks and didn't want to get vaccinated. But I think that like that mindset was like all ready to go from the 80s.
Yeah.
Of like, oh, good. Here's a terminal illness who's killing people we don't like.
Right. That does translate pretty well into the nowadays.
Yeah.
I saw somewhere, and you know, it's like the internet, you never know like what's doctored, like what's Photoshop or photocopied and pasted.
Right.
But it was like some sort of poster of conservative people in the 80s wearing masks, and it had to do with HIV, and it was like, look, they did wear masks. And it's, I don't know if that's real, but
like whether it's real or not, I remember at the time as a kid, like there was a lot of misinformation about how AIDS was spread.
Right. And then it's toward the end of this story, right? Like we're entering the, what was it called? That narrative of through no fault of their own. Do you remember that? Nightmare. Like she contracted HIV through no fault of her own, through a blood transfusion. It's like sex is someone's fault.
Or
that was, I guess that was also back when, like, you know, it was like lifestyle choice. This is your lifestyle choice.
Right. So, yeah, because that was like the phase of anti-gay discrimination, that it was a lifestyle and it was a choice.
Right.
And it was, yeah, and that's actually why it's kind of nice to see this story, because in some ways it's very relevant in terms of the pandemic and in terms, you know, there are very universal things. There are things that are very relevant to 2020. And it's also kind of a stark reminder that we have come a long way, mm-hmm. you know, at least in some ways. But what you were saying about how, you know, people are saying, oh, we've never been through anything like COVID. We've never been through a pandemic like this. That history is kind of being erased. And it's very worthwhile mm-hmm. to, you know, not just for the younger queer community who didn't live through this and is part of the history, but for the, you know, country as a whole.
Right. Yeah. Like, I feel like it may have been like, yeah, this is for the, you know, younger queer people coming up who don't remember AIDS. Like that might've been sort of the main reason why this is a great story in 2019. And now it's like, oh no, this is like the story for everyone for sure.
Yeah.
You know, he was diagnosed in the early 80s and he's arrested and finds out that, you know, he's undetectable in the early aughts. And so this is like 20 years. It's like an overview of that,
the whole,
you know,
era.
So many stages. It's like, first there's, you know, not even any medication to treat it. And then the medication's not working. And then, you know, we've got like all these different narratives. Like it's sort of like the lifespan of a pandemic. I'm just going to call it a pandemic.
Well, so who do you see playing Mark and who do you see playing the brother?
Okay. So my initial thought, I was thinking Matt Bomer for this is so obvious for Mark, and this is very silly, but Henry Cavill, is that his name, as Luke? And Henry Cavill is not, he's not queer, I don't think, as far as I know. So this is like, I broke my own rule, but I just think that people really want to see them as brothers, honestly, first of all.
You know, it's funny. I also had Henry Cavill. I'm not sure if it's Cavill or Cavill, but I had him too, because he's the athletic, confident older brother that Mark was always in the mm-hmm. shadow of, like, you know, he kind of saw his brother as Superman. So put Superman in there.
Yes, exactly. So I don't know if you saw the season 3 of The Sinner with Matt Bomer. So yeah, I think his breakout role is White Collar, where he played a scam artist. So that's hilarious. I didn't think of that. But in this latest season of The Sinner, he plays this sort of like, he's like married, has this sort of idyllic life. And then someone from his past comes in and he becomes like very nihilistic. And so it's like, he has that sort of like clean cut underneath him, but he can put on this like grittiness over it. And I think that that's perfect. And yes, Henry Cavill is Superman. So there you go.
And also I'm pulling up a picture of Matt Bomer. He looks remarkably like Henry Cavill. So
right. Just like, if there's some people that you just want to see as related in movies.
Yeah.
And this is a pair.
That's perfect. And that's better than my choice for Mark. I had Andrew Scott, who was Moriarty on Sherlock and the hot priest on Fleabag.
Okay.
Because he's gay. He's got a disarming presence. You can absolutely believe him as somebody who could get away with anything.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, you know, he plays Professor Moriarty on Sherlock. He's very, like, he comes across as, like, very smart and very kind of slippery and, you know, is a master criminal. And on Fleabag, he's a priest who is flirting with the main character and is kind of a little transgressive there. Like, and he's also just somebody who's got he's a terrific actor. He's got a lot of range. He's very charming. But my one sort of issue with my own choice is that he's 45. And
that was my issue too, that these are older people.
Yeah, but
Matt Bomer is also 44, I think.
He doesn't look it. Right. But it's a story that takes place over 20 years. So you're either going to age him down or age him up.
I did think of, like, if we want to do like the older actor, younger actor, I was thinking as the younger actor, Colm Scott Howells, who's in It's a Sin, and then the older actor, Luke Evans. So these are both Welsh actors. I don't know if they could play, like, I don't know. Like, mostly I was thinking, like, for the look of them and the fact that, you know, they're both gay, they're both good actors, and they look alike. And they, to me, like, sort of look like what I think of as Mark and I couldn't think of a Luke, an older, I couldn't think of anyone else as Luke except for Henry.
Well, and he was also the first person I thought of, so he's clearly the right choice.
Right, yeah. And then the other person I was thinking of is Max Jenkins, and he was in, the only things that come to mind are, I don't know if this is like what he's known for. He's in Dead to Me on Netflix. He plays like the business partner, and he plays a love interest in Special, which is also a Netflix show. But he just has this like wiriness. He seems like a, you know, like a good boy, like a good Christian boy, but he also like, I can just see him like sort of like sinking into a role about, I don't know, scamming and drug addiction. I don't know why. I look at him and I just like see it in him.
The only other name I had for Luke was Zachary Quinto.
Yeah.
And he's also somebody who, you know, can kind of play clean cut and straightforward, but also actually he could also kind of be, he could sort of play either brother. And I think he's also maybe a little too old.
Yeah.
44. The problem is with casting younger actors is that actors with a shorter resume, you're not always as confident about what they can do, and you have less of a sense of them. And like, I always joke in this show that if I need anybody under the age of 20, I just go to the cast of Stranger Things, because they're the only like, you know,
right.
kid actors that I know. But even casting somebody in their 20s or whatever, you know, all the names we've thrown out are sort of pretty established, and you kind of know them. The other funny thing is, looking at Quinto's IMDb, last year he did a voice role as Lex Luthor in some animated Superman thing. So we're stuck on Superman one way or the other.
Apparently, yeah. I like that. I feel like I'm fine suspending disbelief about age in movies. Like, I always think of Florence Pugh. Is that her name?
Yeah.
In Little Women, and like how hilarious it was that she played young Amy and older Amy. It was just like her in the schoolhouse. Like, it just, I don't know, like, it just added this layer that I found like so funny. Although, yeah, Matt Bomer and Henry Cavill are like so extraordinarily like movie star handsome.
Right, exactly.
I think it wouldn't be too hard to believe that they were like, he starts in 1988. If we're starting with like the moment where they're having this conversation and telling each other, they're in their 30s. So I'm like,
already? Okay, well then that's fine.
Yeah.
We're also conditioned by a lifetime of watching like 27-year-olds play high school students.
Sure.
To not really have any idea what age anybody is in a movie.
Exactly. Oh, I also have one more.
Yeah.
So there's a sister, and I have Jill Nader, who's a British actress who was like very active as a caregiver and an advocate and an activist during HIV AIDS crisis. So I just thought she would be good as like a little Easter egg as their sister.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I like that kind of casting. And she's also Welsh.
Oh, yeah. Look at that. A lot of these people are from It's a Sin, which is like the reference point for contemporary HIV AIDS storytelling.
Yeah, yeah. So that's our movie. If you have any thoughts on con artists, cheating death, or other movies that need to get made, hit us up on Twitter at YMovie. Thanks again to Kim Daly. Her book, The True Crime File, is available for pre-order now, and you can find it at your local independent bookstore on May 10th. And you can read student journalism, hear college radio, and listen to other lesser podcasts on our parent website, subjectmedia.org. Keep yourself sane, get yourself boosted, and we'll be back next time on
Why is this not a movie?